Radio station WJR presents 50 Golden Years of Broadcasting.
This is Lowell Thomas in New York. He made it. Charles A. Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy as they call him, landed at Le Bourget Airport, Paris.
But I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love.
Vor uns liegt Deutschland, in uns marschiert Deutschland, und hinter uns kommt Deutschland.
The Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin.
The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
We will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God.
A press association has just announced that President Roosevelt is dead.
Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always.
Over the past centuries, of the millions of creatures that dwell on our planet Earth, man alone has developed the science of technical communication. It is this very aspect that promoted and furthered his progress. Man's knowledge of how to disseminate his ideas, aspirations, and his hostilities make him different than the animal. From the beginning, man attempted to communicate with his friends and enemies, first using the trumpet, then the heliograph, then later the semaphore, the Leyden jar, the electric magnet. Samuel Morse, Cyrus Field, Alexander Bell, James Maxwell invented, developed, and improved their ideas. But it was not until the work of Marconi that the goal of sending the human voice through the air became a reality. It was this knowledge which had already been imparted, and some embellishment by Lee DeForest and David Sarnoff, that from somewhere beyond the ether came forth a medium called radio. Radio would have profound effects on the social and economic life of the world. Thus, it came into being, a wailing young brat demonstrating with Victrola records and election returns. But within one half century, the newborn babe would mature and grow, would captivate the minds and hearts of the multitude, serving as its voice, its brain, its very being. The radio spoke.
We have a press report over the wires. We hope that it is unconfirmed, but we have to doubt it, that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination.
Yeah, there is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's the man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Some men see things as they are and say why. I dream things that never were and say why not.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Across every town in America, radio's voice was heard. And it's fairly safe to say that no matter where people lived and worked, they heard the New England twang of Fred Allen, the clipped accents of H.V. Kaltenborn, the twitter of Gracie Allen, the thundering hooves of the great horse Silver, Edward R. Murrow intoning, "This is London." By its very nature, radio was compelled to enlist the very imagination of the listener, and this is why radio has survived. But there is no place in the world today where this quality is maintained, as in the pulsing, vibrant city of Detroit, Michigan. For 50 years, riding the airwaves, listening, watching, relating, was a voice that became more unique and varied, more authoritative, more imaginative, while others at the same time would rise, remain a while, and fall. There was something in the mystique of this new voice, something indefinable. It was that way on this day, 50 years ago. And it's that way today, 5 decades later. Let me introduce you to him. He was born May 4th, 1922. Place of birth, Mid-America. With 50,000 watts, he booms out from his home at 760 on the AM dial. He is qualified with education and experience, the former, war and peace. And his exceptional experience has included news, drama, documentary, music, comedy. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
WJR Radio is Detroit, serving Mid-America and the nation. For 50 great years and the best is yet to come.
WJR is many things to many people. Its integrity, its discretion, it's a certain wholesomeness. It thrives on unparalleled uniqueness. It possesses a character through the human voice which very few stations achieve. Perhaps it's just that. Its character is best expressed by its voice.
Make Way for Youth has come to you from CBS Radio and WJR in Detroit. This is Jim Garrett speaking.
View of life and living in the Great Lakes area. A lively look at people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus by...
Good morning, everyone.
That's going to do it for us. Tomorrow afternoon, 2:15 to 6 o'clock, let's get back at it. This is Jimmy Lantz, and if you're on your way home, drive carefully. Remember, the family's waiting for you. Good night.
This is Gene Elzey. See you next week with Music for Moderns.
Hi, this is J.P. McCarthy.
These are only a few of the voices that have made WJR one of the leaders in the broadcasting field. And yet, there is something else.
WJR has a long-standing heritage. This sounds a little bit unctuous, but it's true. A long-standing heritage of distinguished programming and public service. All JR history, the men that... Eventually were promoted to general manager and presidents were former program directors. Way back to Leo Fitzpatrick, he was a program man, a program director, then made general manager. John Pett was a program director, then general manager, then president, then chairman of the board. Worth Kramer, program director, then a general manager. And the way to succession to the throne here for years has been through programming. And as a result of this, programming was foremost in the minds of the people that ran JR, and we felt with the programming and with the large audience that good programming attracts, you can sell well. And to the credit of Capital Cities, when they bought WJR, they inherited this great programming. And they felt that, one, they had a good thing. They weren't buying a distressed piece of radio property. And they were very liberal in spending money and encouraging creative ideas to even make it better. And so with this heritage and with all the people having a programming and public service background, and then with Capital Cities having a full appreciation of the worth of this type of background, why, I think JR is just... kept with its tradition, even added further luster to its tradition of fine public service and programming performance. And I've seen it, and fact is, in the last 4 or 5 years, we probably have won more awards than ever before. We now have 2 Peabody Awards back-to-back. Usually one station's very proud of it, can have one of them.
The voice of James Quello, former program director... and today, station manager and vice president of WJR. In this day and age, when the medium of the tube draws most of the pundits' attention and radio basks in the twilight of Remember When, it seems in order here on the 50th anniversary to take a look at where we've been and discover how it all began. Generally speaking, pinpointing the beginning of the golden age of radio is a fairly easy thing to do. But during this nostalgia period that we're experiencing, all one has to do is pick up one of the hundreds of books which concerns the heyday of broadcasting, or listen to one of the many recordings which have captured the sounds of what radio did and when. But in tracing WJR's past, We must go back before the advent of recordings and aeroplanes. Not quite as far back as Gutenberg's press, but 50 years is quite a long time. So, come along with me and discover for yourself how it all came to be.
Remember the golden days, the entertaining nights of
radio.
I'll never forget the sounds and not the sights of
radio.
Remember Merton, Marge, Dick and Fay,
Lum and Abner and
I love their voices.
Hello, Amos. This is Andy.
Who needed places?
Art and Sandy.
The glorious days are gone. They glorified the name of
radio.
And even if they return, it wouldn't be the same. I know. Now, TV's probably just as good. But you can't close your eyes and enjoy it like you could with radio.
Broadcasting was a young field in the year of 1922, and it attracted young people. Actors, directors, writers, producers were to come later. But in the beginning, if you had talent, were willing and manageable, and salary was the last thing in your mind, then WCX was the place for you.
C.D. Tomey was the original manager of WCX. And his first full-time announcer was a man by the name of Ted Harrington. And Merrill Mitchell, who was about 5 feet tall, was the first chief engineer and constructed the original transmitter, which was of 500 watts. Now, that was located.
Norm White goes on to say that the studios were located in the original Free Press building down on West Lafayette, just a couple doors west of Griswold Street, and across the way on Griswold from that intersection was the old City Hall. The first studios of WCX were located on the ninth floor of the old Free Press building. There was a little control room, perhaps 5 feet by 9 feet, as you entered from the ninth floor hallway. There was a very small reception room where possibly 6 or 8 people could be seated waiting for their turn. And there were 2 little studios, both about 14 by 14, with monk's cloth surrounding all walls. And then if you had a big group, a large type program coming up, perhaps a chorus or a band, the middle monk's cloth could be pulled and it would become one studio, enormous in size, 14 by 28 feet. As Norm White says,
that was the beginning of what now is WJR.
Radio stations in May of 1922 totaled 314, one of which was WCX. The general public considered it a toy.
Radio in those days was something that the owners and the people who were running them, running the stations, had no idea what this thing was. It was a plaything. Sure, there were possibly originally in Detroit, maybe 10, 15, 20,000 folks that had a little Galena set. And you had a little wire called the cat's whisker. And they'd fool around and get a sensitive point on the Galena, and in would come the music or the speaker from the few radio stations that were then in existence. Now,
at the end of 1922, WJR had the birth of what became possibly the most popular radio program in this part of America. It was finally called the Red Apple Club. Neil Tomey, toward the end of the year, had decided to have many of the music men who were called song pluggers congregate for a little program which in those days was considered extremely late. Before that is before 10 o'clock was the time that he established, he got these men together. The Free Press gave a little publicity that there would be some songs sung at that time of night, and all these men got together. Norm White relates the success of this program.
Stayed on the air for about an hour and a half, and the telephones rang and so forth, and there were requests made, well, can you sing this song and that song? So the idea was, what will we call this program? Certainly, it's a success from the amount of telephone calls. So, Neil told me, said, well, we'll offer some kind of a prize to whoever will give us the best name. We'll have sort of a contest. So, he happened to say something like, well, we'll possibly give somebody a big red apple. Well, with the type of headset you had, that big red apple sounded like he had said that this would be the Red Apple Club or something, because somebody wrote in and said, we think your name of the Red Apple Club is wonderful. Well, Tommy thought it was just that unusual name that maybe we will grab that one. So anyway, after about 3 weeks, I believe it was December the 26th, and it was about the third program that we finally named this program the Red Apple Club.
And so for the next 6 or 7 years, it was the most popular program in this part of America. They went on the air every Tuesday night at 10 o'clock and stayed on the air until at least 3:30, 4, sometimes as late as 5 o'clock in the morning. Remember?
The tom-tom beat and the Indian war hopes came on promptly at 10, when Neil Tomey, acting in another of his capacities, that of Big Chief for the Red Applers, announced...
Yes, sir. All the Red Apple Club is here for an evening of music and fun. I said evening, but I mean tomorrow morning, too, because as long as we have requests from the mailbag, and you listeners keep our telephone ringing, we'll keep answering them. Bernice, Norm White, Whispering Will Collins, Muriel Kyle, Charlotte and Mary, Al and Pete, Ford and Glenn, all of us will.
A novelty? Yes. But how would one explain the sale of radio sets which grew so quickly that the manufacturers could not meet the demand? And if it was a plaything, why did administrators find themselves creating the greatest advertising media in the world? Radio had reached the stage where it actually contributed a great deal of happiness and had become one of the most influential forces in American life. It stimulated activity. New expressions became popular. New programs were being offered. New stars were born. And behind the scenes in Detroit, events were transpiring that would develop one of the greatest independent radio stations in the country.
WJR was formed in 1925 by the Jewett Radio and Phonograph Company. They went to the Free Press, who at that time had what was considered one of the finest wavelengths in all of radio, right in the center of the dial. And they made a deal that they would construct the most modern transmitter alongside of their factory on the west outskirts of Pontiac. They would pay all expenses for all of the operation of the station and share time. So that became a reality, and in August of 1925, WJR, the Jewett Radio and Phonograph Company, started sharing time with WCX.
The first manager of that station was Howard Campbell, and his assistant was Corley Kirby. And they brought the famous Leo Fitzpatrick, who had been the merry old chief of the Kansas City Nighthawks, into Detroit. They wanted nothing but the finest, and he was the biggest name. He was on the air every night at midnight with a Coon Sanders Orchestra, and they brought this Leo Fitzpatrick to Detroit to be their program director. So he opened up the station in August of 1925. But as time wore on, money gave out. Jewett Radio and Phonograph Company didn't sell enough radio sets and phonograph sets to stay in existence, so they went into bankruptcy. Stroud and Company of Philadelphia became the receivers, and they immediately appointed Leo Fitzpatrick as their manager. Once again, here's Norm White.
This Irishman, Leo Fitzpatrick, with his terrific personality, in no time was the idol of all the people of Detroit. Big businessmen, little businessmen, and just the common listener, they all loved this Irishman. So somewhere along the line in I would guess either in late 1925 or the early early 1926, he met some of the Fisher brothers. And through the Fisher brothers, he met a man by the name of Richards, George A. Dick Richards, and interested Mr. Richards, who at that time had the Oakland Pontiac distributorship for Wayne County, Oakland County, and Macomb County. He was the largest distributor of automobiles in the world. So anyway, Richards, seeing a great thing, great potential, great future for radio, got interested, and he took an option on purchasing WCX WJR, or the WJR end of it, first of all, which he did.
It was on the 26th of December of 1926 that Mr. George Richards took over the Jewett end of the operation with the call letters WJR and went on the air. He also took advantage of an option to purchase outright WJR, which he did so. And on September the 1st, 1926, it all started. It was said of Mr. Richards,
"And he never in the world could have made a better deal than that."
It was this man, Richards, who accomplished things in radio that few in the nation envisioned. He brought to Mid-America Paul Whiteman, who was at the height of his popularity, and paid the musicians $100 for each car they sold. They said he was crazy, but Richards realized that radio would be of great interest to the people, a means by which to sell products. Richards became the owner of three top 50,000-watt stations in the country, in Cleveland, Los Angeles, and Detroit. In retrospect, one may ask, who was he? Why was he so successful? What made him different?
And he was the George Washington Hill, if people will remember George Washington Hill of radio. He was very strong in his likes and dislikes, a promotional and sales genius in his day. And here's a man who quit school in the eighth grade, starts selling shoes to support himself and help support his mother. Then he starts selling tires and sold some very big accounts.
He was a hard-driving man. He was a man who wanted nothing less than perfection. So if there was ever a man who belonged in radio at that time to see that this little thing that so far was just a little plaything and now was getting old enough to start going someplace, the networks had just started there in 1925 and 1926. And so he really saw that this station really grew, and only in the finest manner. Those that he were his friends were the truest type of friends. And of course, he had a lot of people that didn't agree with him on many of his things. For instance, as early as 1929, he started warning all of the businessmen in Detroit about this the communist thing. And they all said, "Oh, that crazy Dick Richards." Well, he lived to see that every word he told them was correct. And there was the fear of communism hurting this country and so forth. Above all things, if I were to pay a tribute to Mr. Richards, he was a great American.
During the years that George Richards was at the helm of WJR, there was no doubt about where he stood concerning his country. He was proud and traditional. And though this recording is not technically perfect, if you listen closely, you will discover for yourself how George Richards felt about America when wars and rumors of wars engulfed the land.
"I gotta get out of the way. If they are sick, go and lay down somewhere and forget it. This is time for good, red-blooded Americans to wake up and protect our country. And those that don't like our country, then get the hell out of here, and the quicker they do it, the better we'll all be off." "I don't mean to swear, ladies, I apologize, but that's the way I feel, and I think I think that's the way you all feel."
Yet the life of Mr. Richards was filled with lighter moments. Here, Jim Queller relates a tale which demonstrates man's quirks, man's foible.
Mr. Richards coming in, you know, they owned the place almost lock, stock, and barrel, 90-some percent of it, and every time he came in, it was just like the inspecting general coming in. Everyone tidied up their desks, and everything had to be just right, because he was out in the coast. He'd come in town 6-7 times a year, and he saw this hat, and made some kind of a comment about getting sloppy, and just sailed the hat right out the window. And, of course, it happened to belong to a large JR client who didn't particularly appreciate the owner of the station throwing his hat out the window and canceled his contract.
Mr. George Richards was a man of his time.
He was a tough driver. If he wanted an office boy, you had to be the best office boy in Detroit. And if he wanted an announcer, you had to be the best announcer. Regardless of what the job was, money didn't mean anything, but you had to be the best. And he was a tough customer to work for. But you had to deliver, and if you did, you were very, very highly rewarded.
And so in the following years, it was the voice of Mid-America which was heard. Sometimes WJR's voice was troubled and full of verbal pyrotechnics.
That more than 60% of our people professed no affiliation with any church whatsoever. Too often the churches themselves fail to emphasize the virtues of Christian justice and charity. Too often the pulpit sounded the sophism of
the voice of Father Coughlin.
Or as in the days of the great prophet, they preached peace when there was no peace.
At other times, it was serene, homey, and nostalgic.
Even the roses round the porch must blossom year by year before they come apart here, suggesting someone dear who used to love them long ago. Trained them just to run the way they do so.
Poet Edgar Guest.
The early morning sun. You gotta love each brick and stone from cellar up to dome. It takes a heap of living in a house to make it home.
These were the personalities. These were the voices that made WJR the great voice of the Great Lakes. For the 50 years that WJR has been on the air, there has always been an element of originality, an ingredient known as professional excellence. It is a heritage which has been handed down by program directors and producers, writers, singers and musicians, and announcers. Much of this professionalism has lingered on to this very day. Let us take music, for example. Here, music director Jimmy Clark reminisces.
Well, of course, when I first started as an arranger, I didn't have the opportunity to write for the FOB orchestra, which, as I say, was 35 men. And I was the first, and that was the first time I'd ever written for that many men. And I'm sort of self-taught in music, as a matter of fact. So it was a lot of fun to try my hand at writing for an orchestra that large. And surprisingly and luckily, it came out very well, and it was quite an opportunity for me, and I enjoyed it. And as a result, I was quite proud of the fact that I was writing for that size band and that important a show. For instance, I was doing some creative music, just off-the-cuff creative music, for Toby David reading the comic strips on Sunday, for instance, and the creative stuff that I did with the Hermit's Cave. It was all a lot of fun. And that's really a description of my whole 28 years here. It's been 28 years of fun.
Live music on WJR, and there was a lot of it.
Prosperity, F-O-B.
When you get that brother run, let it go, let it go, let it go, let it go.
Don't let troubles run your day.
You can send them on their way.
Let it go, let it go, let it go, let it go.
In dark clouds that go by, they'll soon go by.
The year is 1938. From the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building, FOB. ...1941, and listeners heard from The Music Men.
May we banish every care with the music on the air.
8:30 of a Wednesday morning here in the city of Detroit, and that means that The Music Men, Don Large, Harold Keene, and John McKenzie, are right back at you with a quarter hour of trio doings.
B-I-5, B-O-4...
Hey, you take this one, Uncle Don.
In WJR's golden age of radio, there was one man who was a jack of all trades and master of many. His southern drawl was familiar to many, whether it was a documentary, a farm show, or a news program, or a sentimental nostalgic moment found in Mother's album.
My mother used to say, no need to weep because you haven't gotten fame or gold. For truth and right are yours, and they will keep long after worldly goods are bought and sold. We recall to your memory Abraham Lincoln's immortal tribute. All that I am, all that I hope to be, I owe to my angel mother. Now a program transcribed from the time-yellowed leaves of a mother's album. A program dedicated to your mother and to mine, and to the glory that is motherhood. I used to watch my mother's face as music floated through the air, and as the melody pervaded space, I saw a transformation taking place, a bit of smiling, gentle heaven there.
The old silver fox. If there is a great voice of the Great Lakes, it belonged to Charlie Park.
Mother's Album is an endowed program, lovingly dedicated in the memory of Mrs. Stella R. Richards to mothers everywhere. We invite you to listen again next Sunday to another in this unending transcribed series. This is Charles Park speaking.
If there was one program which could have been labeled the most popular, or perhaps the most listened to, it was an original production from WJR written by Eric Howlett and Jerry Elliott. This husband and wife team combined the proper ingredients from The Shadow, Inner Sanctum, and all the other horror shows to concoct one of the weirdest characters portrayed for the listeners by Clark Ryder. The program was called The Hermit's Cave.
Ghost stories. Weird stories. And murders, too. The hermit knows of them all. Turn out your lights. Turn them out. For a night while your Yuletide tapers burn brightly and your Christmas tree lights cast a reflection of warmth and goodwill for each passing traveler, your old hermit tells you a story of one man's salvation on a Christmas of long ago.
This was what people pretty much heard back in the 1940s. Entertainment for an America at war. They sang about it. They talked about it. Some, like sportscaster Tommy Harmon, did something about it.
I don't really know how to start this next paragraph in my sports review. It seems to me that I'm entering the greatest sports arena the world has ever known, and it's with mingled feelings that I do this. Anyone who Saturday after Saturday has tromped out on the gridiron in front of 80,000 persons never gets over the thrill. Tonight, I'm more thrilled than at any time in my life. Tonight, I'm saying so long to all of you sport fans for, well, who can tell? I never have been able to adequately describe the feeling that I had when I hung old 98 for the last time. I'd learned to treasure it with something akin to real affection. Then I said goodbye to moleskins and hello to a microphone. I was elated that I was still in sports and still in contact with all the sport fans to whom I owe all my gridiron glory. Tonight, I'm hanging up this microphone just like I did old 98.
Tommy Harmon and millions just like him marched off to war. Harmon was one of the top sportscasters in the country. He would be one among the many who would relate the exciting moments on the field of sports. Sports would play a big part in WJR's programming, bringing to the fan the thrilling account of a pennant-winning season.
Three men on, two men out, game tied 1-1 in the ninth inning. McDaniel checking his time with Jake Gibbs. The tall right-hander ready to go to work again. And the windup and the pitch. He swings a line shot. Base hit. Right field. The Tigers win it. Here comes K-Line to score. And it's all over. Donward singles. The Tigers mob Don. K-Line has scored. The fans are steaming on the field. And the Tigers have won their first pennant since 1945.
The dramatic unfolding of gridiron action.
Rather out wide as a flank of the right. Eye formation in the backfield. Slade pitching it back to Taylor. Taylor off the tackle. Good hard running.
Sports
back.
Director Bob Reynolds.
Go all the way for a touchdown. And he does. 38 yards. No flag on the play. And the Wolverines lead it 6-0.
On WJR, the Detroit Lions with Van Patrick.
Deep Jesse along with Al Clark. And here's Percival's kick. High end over end kick. And Jesse waits for it. Takes it in the end zone. He comes back to the 5, goes to the 10, picks up a block at the 15, he's to the 20, the 25, the 30, the 35, he's at the 40, the 45, the 50, the 45, the 40, the 35, the 30, the 25, 20, 15, 10, 5, touchdown!
The brilliant maneuvering in the game of basketball is described by Paul Carey.
Pressure in the backcourt, almost a knockaway by Jake Jones. Walker picking up the ball, one-on-one against Jones, still in the backcourt. Jimmy gets it across the line. Moves toward the middle of the court, talking to his forwards, looking for them to cut, to set it up. Davis is on the left side. Walker doing his thing. Bangs one up, no good. Comives takes it away from Van Arsdale to Davis. Davis hangs on, over on the left side. Walker's open, he scores!
The war would end. The boys would come home. And WJR set about the task of making continued gains. A tougher job, for television was on the horizon, but still for radio and WJR, those wonderful moments of glory. What was it like?
In those days, as I recall, radio of the late 48s, this is a funny comparison, but it was more like television today. You had the network with big stars on at night. Night was your prime time, not the morning traffic time or the afternoon traffic time. But you rode the networks, and you were as strong as your network, usually. Plus, you bought syndicated features. You had soap operas coming in. They'd buy you. Will you clear for this soap opera? Will you clear for this suspense drama? So we had some music. We had a lot of drama. We had, the Jack Bennies and the Amos and the Andes and all the other stars. And that was it. And then the nature of it changed with the advent of television. Television became the drama medium. And the prime time, radio's prime time in the evening, changed. That was television's prime time. All of a sudden, you had people in the morning that wanted to be informed and were riding to work in their cars. And radio got to be more important 6 to 10 in the morning and 4 to 7 in the evening than ever before. And that became our prime time. And programming changed from one where drama and big extravaganza audio shows, radio shows, were the big attraction to really news being very important, documentaries being important, music being important, and disc jockeys even being important. Although for years here, we wouldn't even allow our disc jockeys to be called disc jockeys. They used to laugh at us. Newspapermen said, well, if you're referring to NHJR, you have to refer to them as on-the-air personalities. They don't have disc jockeys. They needled us a little bit, but nevertheless, they seem to respect it. And we kind of like this. We wanted to be just a little bit stuffy and to be just above the average radio station. And as I said, that's the way it developed. And today, we still have it. We have the Metropolitan Opera. We have Adventures in Good Music. We have Kaleidoscope. Certainly real programs we're very proud of.
Programs which bring pride today are but throwbacks to good things that WJR had accomplished in the past. And from these programs and from these accomplishments came almost legendary personalities. One man who's done it all, Bud Guest.
Time once again for another edition of Cornflakes, your own cooperative comedy column of the air, presented by Bond's Clothes and featuring Bud Guest. This is Dale McIntyre, who tries to get a word in edgewise for Bond's from time to time, but you'll have to wait to hear my first commercial until after Bud has been given a start on a batch of banter he has ready for today. So here he is, Colonel Corn, your flaky philosopher, Bud Guest.
Good afternoon, Detroit's more discriminating dialers. How many of you know of the painter of miniatures who set up shop in New York after 8 years of study?
And from the year of 1948, Bud was one of the featured performers on Let's Get Around.
Say, by the way, nobody believes you when you tell them you've been working in the salt mines all day. I tried it with my wife after our experience. If I ever had a day in the salt mines, I said as I returned home. Tough day at the office, hey, she said. No, dear, the salt mines. Honestly, I've been down in the salt mines. Maybe now she'll believe me. It was a real thrill, all right, one I'll never forget, especially that ride down.
Bud will be best remembered for his present series on the sunny side of the street. But who can forget Guest House?
Here we go. Hi there. Bud Guest is this end of the line, along with Fred Kendall, Jimmy Clark, and Rosemary McGann.
Hi, golly, we're happy you were with us today because it must be raining outside. We are absolutely packed with customers in our little audition room there. They're peering at us through the glass. As I said, it must be raining outside, and they said it is. We just came in to get out of the rain and see what goes on up here. How are you, Fred?
Fine, Bud, how are you?
I'm fine. Will you sing for us, old dear?
Yeah, we have a song called I Hear the Music Now.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
On the Guest House program, the fine voice of Fred Kendall, which had been recognized nationally by no less a personality than Arthur Godfrey.
Well, hello there. How are you? What's your name?
I'm Ron Gamble, Arthur.
Ron Gamble. Where are you from, son?
From Detroit.
Detroit. What do you do out there?
I'm with radio station WJR in Detroit, Arthur.
Oh, is that so? What do you do there?
Well, I have an afternoon show, 1 hour, 5 days a week.
1 hour, 5 days a week. What do you do on that show?
Well, I'm the master of ceremonies for an orchestra and vocalist show.
Thanks ever so much for coming. Take your tea with you.
Yeah, I do that.
And let's bring on into the Lipton spotlight, Fred Kendall. Now for a winner tonight. We'll bring them out here in the same order in which they appeared. First of all was the baritone Ronald Rogers.
Wait a minute. Oh, I got plenty of nothing. Nothing plenty for me. I got no sun. Got no moon.
And the next one is the girl pianist Marcella Briggs. Then there was Helen Carroll and the Swan Tone.
what is this thing called love? This funny thing called love.
And then Fred Kendall, the tenor.
You're a little bit of heaven.
I guess that leaves no doubt in anyone's mind that the winner tonight is Fred Kendall, the tenor.
Some great talent to be heard on WJR. Singers included Jim Doolan, Judy Carroll, and of course, Rosemary McGann.
Oh, moon, grow bright and make this endless day.
Light, the bright, the carefree musical moments. But through the years, WJR has viewed the more serious side of the picture.
Good morning. This is Dave White with the 9 o'clock news. This is Oscar Frenette, WJR News. The Labor Department has refused to bend its rules to help the city of Detroit relieve its financial crisis. Good morning, Dave Taylor, WJR News. An American congressman expelled from Russia. A crackdown on government corruption in South Vietnam. Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio.
The station excels in performance when called to venture beyond the call of duty, as in this national story of the year of 1953.
This is Ed Murrow in New York. Last Monday night at approximately 8:32 p.m., a savage tornado struck the northern suburban area of Flint, Michigan. This tornado struck, as they all do, without warning. It came as some families were sitting in what they thought was the snug safety of their homes. The children were in bed.
The community, the state, the people. They were all served, and WJR was there to spearhead the dissemination of information.
But no, two things are just outstanding in my mind, and I was so proud of JR. One of them was the Flint tornado, the most devastating and serious tornado to hit our state. And our mobile unit, at the time we had a mobile unit, went directly to Flint. And right in the center of it, it was set up as a command post for the governor and for the state police and for the civil defense people. And our mobile unit was used as a headquarters, as a command post. And our newsmen responded well. We covered it, I think, in good taste. And I don't know, there's just a feeling that we were on top of the story. We were performing a great service at the same time we were with it. The other time is probably it's just a fact. The largest story, we don't like to refer to it, but the largest international story in the history of Detroit came during the riots.
Put your hands in the air!
In a church steeple now. The officers have just...
Stand up and put your hands up in the air.
Told a man to stand up and put his hands up in the air.
Hey, you got a spotlight?
As we were driving down the street...
You in the steeple!
They spotted him.
Stand up and put your hands in the air.
Now they have lights on him. Still no movement from the steeple. Still no movement. He's ducked down. He's hiding low. The men are creeping across the street, right as the night is again broken by gunfire.
The voice of Len Walter, newsman, WJR, during the 1967 Detroit riots.
We hear sirens wailing. More men are coming to the scene. Squad cars are being used as shields.
Hold your fire.
This is the third such incident that we've witnessed in the past 15 minutes.
Service beyond the call of duty. The Flint tornado. The Detroit riot. This is what we refer to, and what the listener constantly refers to, as that which makes WJR first among the many. From near disaster to achievement and fulfillment, broadcasting the last word first. But there is another side of the coin, the moments when the sense of humor has a field day. WJR has a chance to laugh at itself. One such moment, provided by former news director Bill Sheehan.
The Detroit Pistons dropped a game with the Cincinnati Royals last night, 114-99. Tonight, the Pistons and Syracuse play, broadcast time 9:30 on WJR. The weather for Detroit and for all the area, fair and cold, today and tonight, tomorrow fair, a little warmer. The temperature now in Detroit is 8 o'clock, is 8 degrees. Today's high will be 22 and low tonight, 17.
On the sports scene, the Detroit Pistons were beaten tonight by the Cincinnati Royals in the first game of a twin bill played at...
Sportsman John Bell.
Garden. In that one, the Cincinnati club came away from a halftime deficit to pour it on in the last half with the final score in that one, the Cincinnati Royals 121, the Pistons 101. Now the weather outlook for Detroit and vicinity. Colder tonight, fair skies forecast, but becoming warmer tomorrow, Thursday night, or rather Wednesday night and Thursday. Meanwhile, the outlook for Friday, high winds followed by high skirts followed by me. Hey, I lost everything. What'd you do with the weather?
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome once again to our little hodgepodge of music, musings, and miscellany. I'm Jack Harris, here to do a little singing, and we have Jimmy Clark, the boys in the damn band, to do a lot of...
And also be made partakers of his resurrection through the same Jesus Christ, our Lord.
And from Ted Strasser to Lowell Thomas.
Have you a few more unforgettable words?
About a new book called Diet or Die. Author, Mrs. Celesta Geyer, perhaps better known to millions of carnival fans as the one-time Dolly Dimples. Remember, the world's most beautiful fat lady? That was the billing Mrs. Geyer used when she weighed 555 pounds. Count them, 555 pounds. Now a svelte 122. She tells in her book how she did it, following the advice of a doctor who told her after a near fatal heart attack to diet or die. The secret of effective weight loss, massive willpower, said Mrs. Geyer, adding that her own willpower was strengthened by the memory. Well, anyhow, she said that her fat friends from carnival life died at an early age, later buried from the back of a truck. Those her own words. Why truck? Because, said Mrs. Geyer, they were too big for a hearse.
Been so much that has happened, so many firsts, so many good things, one may logically ask, what's left? What's left? The future. A man who will play a large part in WJR's future and in its programming is program director Joseph P. McCarthy. He's better known as JP to his many thousands of listeners, Detroit's top broadcasting personality, glib, quick, articulate, but a man who envisions new and varied approaches for WJR.
See us continue to be as dominant in our own market as we have been, naturally. That becomes, as you well know, very difficult. You must remember, as recently as when I came back from San Francisco in 1965, that there were really only seven other competitive signals in the Detroit area. 7 a.m. stations. FM really was not a factor at the time. Today, 7 years later, there are 27, and there may be 28 or 29 at the moment, but 27 signals competing for the audience pie. Therefore, there has been a proliferation of audience in every other major market in the country. We haven't really suffered from this yet. I think that that frankly is inevitable, okay? It just has to happen. When your competition quadruples, some part of the audience has to be drained away. I would always hope that we would maintain our high standards of programming. That's always been our idea. And I don't know what that'll mean a year from now or 5 years from now. We'll always have to compete, and I think we always will effectively with the best programming we can come up with. It really depends on the time.
And so this is just about the end of our story. 1 hour of programming in an attempt to tell a story that has taken 50 years to develop. In our mind, perhaps it's best summed up by the boss, Mr. William James.
It is a great privilege to be general manager of radio station WJR. I candidly admit that the pleasure one derives from seeing the community served and the vast public entertained is a tremendously satisfying thing. The staff, and that includes not only the on-the-air people, but the people behind the scenes as well, are a most distinguished group of people with which to work. And as long as we continue to surround ourselves with this caliber of individual, I am certain WJR will continue to do a most commendable job. For 50 years, we have maintained the highest standards, and I have no doubt that we will sustain this. I personally grew up with WJR, and I am confident that we can maintain the quality of excellence that has made WJR over the years the great voice of the Great Lakes.
Of TV's miracle I'm aware, but I can't help recall what it cost me to repair my